Yeah, welcome to episode 31 of the Management to Zero podcast. Like the last one, this is another one in English. The last one I did with Eric Sui. And now I'm talking to Professor Leif Edvinson. And I want to talk with him about intellectual capital, knowledge management, future centers, and of course, his ideas for the future. Welcome, Leif.
Vielen Dank, and thank you very much.
Before we start with the topic of intellectual capital, I always in the podcast want to talk about how you come to the field, to the domain. I looked you up in the Wikipedia. It says you were born in 1946 in Uppsala in Sweden. You're a Swedish organizational theorist, professor emeritus of the University of Lund, Sweden, in the field of economics and management, a consultant. You did some writing work, some books. You get the award, the Brain of the Year award in 1998, and also the International Knowledge Management Award for your lifetime achievement in 2017. So before we deep into your domain, tell us a little bit what happened between 1946 and the early 90s that brought you to the field of intellectual capital management.
Well, you could say it's about a journey to reduce my ignorance, reduce what I don't know that I don't know. It is related to my curiosity. So many years ago, when I got a scholarship to go to California, I learned that a lot of things in the way of thinking as a student at the University of California, Berkeley. And this was very interesting to compare with. I thought I had a pretty good education from Lund in Sweden, but I really learned to think in Berkeley. And that led me to a question that I ask many people that I meet. Where did you learn to think, actually? So I could now ask you that question as well, Simon. We can talk about that later on. But this is a fundamental dimension of the pedagogics of University of California that was contextual for the development of Silicon Valley. So they trained the brain power of people in that area that later on led to a tremendous growth of companies and Nobel Prizes, etc., in the Silicon and San Francisco area. So I'm very grateful for that. And one of the very simple dimensions of that as a part of a story is that the first semester I didn't get very good grades. And I thought I responded to the questions at the examinations, but not very good outcome when looking into the grading of it. So I went to my professors and asked, what's wrong? And they said that you are just responding to the question. And when you are citing the books, etc., it's just recycling of old shit. So you have actually to take that question and turn it upside down and stretch it and look for the hidden angles, which is very interesting for both you as a student as well as me as professor. So you should challenge me as a professor through your response. And that is something that I really picked up and applied when I was professor in Lund and later on also in Hong Kong. So this was a fundamental insight emerging, and it led to an observation later on that when you start an enterprise, it's very difficult to get funding for it. So I became interested in the credit analysis from a banking viewpoint and funding viewpoint. And of course, it immediately revealed that they were not looking into what is today called intellectual capital and intangibles. So I started to work in a bank to change that. And that was 1990, 2 years before I started in Scandia. And then came the financial crisis and the banks were stuck with their loans. So they were not risk apt to change a new approach, even if that would have been very good for them to do it. Mm-hmm. So then I was recruited by Scandia to apply the emerging insights and test that at Scandia.
And you started working at Scandia then in the early 90s?
No, I started in end of 91 in Scandia.
I had a look earlier this day on, I think, the first paper that I read from you. It was called Developing Intellectual Capital at Scania. It was in the Long Range Planning magazine. And there's a very good introduction where you ask some questions like, when you buy a company, what do you buy? The fixed assets, or do you look for some more sustainable assets? What do you measure? The number of customers, the number of nodes in the network of the virtual corporation? What do you value? The number of working hours, the number of good ideas? So the starting point for you in the field of intellectual capital and the knowledge dimension was the question, what's the value of an organization?
Well, it was a frustration that before I started to work in the bank, I was working with business development. I even in Swedish coined the concept many years ago where you were working with technology development and added the commercial development. And for that purpose, you needed funding. And for that funding, the financial community was not really looking into the value of technologies and intangibles. So it was a tremendous frustration. Why don't you see the value of this emerging intangible? And that led me into the banking sector. And Scandia was a company that was living with those questions that you just read, because we had a unit that was a little bit of a spin-off into a new sector called the unit linked, a new type of insurance and financial savings, which was based on the concept that traditional life insurance is something that you get when you're dead. But if you survive, how does it look like? So we developed a financial service for that circumstance. And that grew from 0.2 billion euro to 20 billion euro during the years I was in Scandia.
And in that paper, you defined intellectual capital as the position of knowledge, applied experience, organizational technology, customers' relationships, and professional skills that provide Scandia with a competitive edge in the market. Tell us a little bit about how you came up with that definition back then.
It is an ongoing journey to refine the taxonomy for intellectual capital. So initially we were looking for a picture and together with my colleagues in Japan, we immediately saw that the Asian illustration for knowledge is usually a tree. And then given the insights from California that you take the question and turn it upside down, we turned the tree upside down, and then we saw that the roots are more important than the fruits. So that was the visual definition of intellectual capital. The wording of it is actually, from a taxonomy viewpoint, the hidden values or the roots, or the derived insights of head value. As derived insights is intellectual, head value is capital. So the Latin word for head is related to capitus. So what is the head value in a growing concern or company or nation? So that's one definition. And later on, we realized that there were two major parts of it, and that is people, and that is something called structural capital. So when people are leaving the enterprise and hopefully return next day, there is something that might be the trademark, it might be patents, it might be networks, it might be software. And all those intangibles are not in the accounting system and not the human capital.
It's mostly on the cost side, the human capital.
Yes. And that goes for customer relationships as well.
And you wrote in that paper that the beginning of your journey was that in 1992, you began to list more than 50 items like core competencies and key persons, IT systems, partners, alliances. And that got so much that you were in need of a more structured approach or categorization. And this is where the two dimensions of human capital and structural capital came from?
Partially. There was another structure which we called Navigator. And this Navigator, or the need for this structure, emerged that when we wanted to communicate to the board of directors of the mother company, Scandia, that we had so much hidden value in the enterprise. So initially we did a video actually to illustrate that. The other part was that we made some numbers on these labels that you just mentioned. And that was a big surprise for the board of directors. So after less than an hour, I said, we need more of this information. And then we started to refine it.
So in terms of communicating this intellectual capital, you need a sort of a balance sheet with just a few items on it. But would you say that when someone starts nowadays to get an overview of his intellectual capital and starts systematically managing it, it's still a good idea to begin to list these items like you did it back then?
Yes. And furthermore, you can add a very little distinguishing part of it. Who owns what you are listing? Because according to the accounting rules, you have to see the asset as something owned by the enterprise. So you might have values that is not owned explicitly. Mm-hmm. But it could also be owned explicitly, but not in the being in the balance sheet.
And I think this is what you said, that everything that's in the human capital box, so to say, is just rented, not owned.
Right. Fundamental insight.
So one task always is to transform human capital into structural capital then?
Exactly. And this is fundamental when you look at startup companies, because they have mainly debts or liabilities. So that's why intellectual liabilities is also very interesting to look into. And the banks are looking at the capability to repay the loans. The venture capitalists are looking for what springboard effect can we generate based on what's in this conglomerate of hidden values. So when you are starting to look at the springboard effect, you realize that this springboard effect is a navigational tool. It's not management.
Another step in the journey was that Scania added the function intellectual capital in addition to other functions like finance or marketing. And you were the director of intellectual capital back then. Why was that necessary? Like, wasn't the head of finance in the position to manage financial capital and intellectual capital at the same time? Do this have to be two functions?
It's about the left and the right side of the brain. And if you are missing one part of it, you don't have a full brain. And that's why you needed to add the function. And most financial directors have no real sense for the intangibles because it's not their job. They have to comply with the accounting standards and the accounting rules and the reporting in a traditional agreed way to the board of directors. It's legally required. But the other consequently, they don't have time and sense for the other dimensions. But the long-term sustainability is dependent on these other dimensions. So if you take all these 17 goals of United Nations of sustainability, they are more or less intangible dimensions or intellectual capital dimensions.
And wouldn't the head of human resources or human relations be a natural counterpart of the head of finance?
It would regarding human capital. But remember, human capital is more or less a liability. And therefore, what's happening to the structural capital, if you are not acknowledging that part, and if you look at the value dimension of these growing companies, especially IT companies, the value is not in human capital. If you take Spotify, for example, they have a number, 300-400 people as human capital employees, but they have more than 100 million users. And that is also human capital, but it's not recorded as human capital.
And the head of human resources is not responsible for these users or these customers.
Brilliant observation. And consequently, they miss the value dimension of it because they are not in charge of the value drivers. They are in charge of the more or less cost drivers.
So before we shift over to the future centers, if someone's interested in that story on developing the idea of intellectual capital and the taxonomy and also the Scandia IC Navigator, is the 1997 book, Intellectual Capital, Realizing Your Company's True Value by Finding Its Hidden Brain Power, the right starting point? Or is there some other source you would point people to?
I think there are a number of sources. One of them is Journal of Intellectual Capital. Journal of Intellectual Capital was started on a recommendation from me in roughly 21 years ago. And today it's listed among those peer-reviewed magazines and owned by Thomson Reuters. And it's a lot of very, very good articles in there of many dimensions of the subject of intellectual capital. Regarding my own story, there are a number of other books. One is called Corporate Longitude. And Corporate Longitude was published 2002. And it's based on the story of the British Navy that misnavigated on after their journeys, because they missed out on one fundamental dimension that was called the longitude. And the longitude problem was a problem for this Navy, and the solution was not coming from the Navy, consequently, because they were a little bit blocked in their perspective. It did not come from the university. It came actually from a watchmaker who was using what is called today phronesis, practical wisdom. And he applied his watch and clock wisdom to the problem to realize that the misnavigation was based on the rotation of the Earth. And the rotation of the Earth is, in layman terms, called the tide, the ebb and flood. So the tide is actually extremely important for navigating a ship. So nowadays it's a standard. We have Greenwich Middle Time, and also the spaceships are navigating based on this. But companies are usually navigating as they didn't know anything about the tide.
So I will link these two books in the show notes of the podcast as well, so people can buy the book, of course.
Yes, and but most important is to pick up on the idea that you have to realize that if you are on a ship and you have the water going out, unless you have a navigational approach, you are lost, actually. You are drifting away. And that is happening to all companies. They are drifting off unless they have a renewal dimension. And this renewal dimension is, of course, very costly, but it's the survival issue.
And it becomes more and more important the more we go into the thing we call the VUCA world, like a volatile, complex, uncertain, and ambiguous world, I believe.
Yes. And that's why the bottom line in the Navigator is renewal.
From this paper on developing intellectual capital at Scania, I picked another thing you called the phases of development in intellectual capital. The phases you mentioned were the missionary phase, a measurement phase, a leadership phase, a technology phase, a capitalizing phase, and a futurizing phase. Perhaps you say a sentence or two for each of the phases, and I think the futurizing phase may be the bridge to the future centers we want to talk in the second part of the podcast about.
So the missionary phase, as a starting point, you have already heard about the need for understanding the intangibles of human capital and the relationships and the renewal. The other part of it is a way to do that, to get to that understanding, is to have a number, some metrics to it. And of course, the most desired metrics is not the only the number of customers, but also the value of the customer, and even more the value of the customer potential base. So you start to see that it's not the position that is enough. You have to have three dimensions in the metrics, and that is position, direction, and speed. And those three dimensions are the same as in navigation: position, direction, and speed. And it's rather simple in a way. And therefore, the accounting system has to be developed into a supplement with those three dimensions, and also if possible, put financial numbers on those three dimensions, which is possible, actually. And what you then start to see that the futurizing is the same as the renewal. And futurizing is actually the impact on renewal or the tide. In what way are you drifting? And are you in control of the drift? And this drifting is leading you to what is called the longitude. And the longitude is a third dimension. You have altitude, latitude, and longitude. And that's why the metric system of enterprises of today are two-dimensional. But we need to develop the third dimension, which is the longitude. And that without that, you cannot fly. Without that, you cannot even have spaceships. And without that, you don't have internet, actually. So therefore, the longitude understanding is essential, but you also need to have the metrics. And this was discovered by this watchmaker I mentioned earlier, some 100 years back. But it didn't become a standard until early 1916. It became a global standard in the world, actually. And so therefore, we are still probably missing out on the metrics for futurizing. But to give you a biological metaphor for it, your body has a certain rhythm in renewing cells. And this speed of renewal is different in different parts of your body. So if you get a wound in your mouth, it recovers in less than a minute. You stop bleeding. And if you break your leg, it takes 90 days to get that to heal. And if you get something in your stomach, it might take some weeks. So you have different speeds of renewal. And the same goes for enterprising. You need to have different speeds of renewal. Otherwise, you are drifting off or you are gradually dying. So just think about the living cell in your body that stops to renew. Then you are dead.
So you mean in the missionary phase, I have to raise awareness in the organization for this mission dimension of navigating in corporate navigation, so to say, and then start measuring and seeing where the fields of action are. And then in the third phase, take leadership on the facts that I find in the measurement.
Yes, and especially renewal and futurizing.
Okay, so... the futurizing phase, I think in the paper you wrote as well that one measure you took in the futurizing phase was to create the Scandia Future Center as a place to think about the future and create the future. So where did that idea of the Future Center come from and what was the Scandia Future Center back then?
The idea came from a kind of frustration again. Because do you get the futurizing to happen in the boardroom or not? And usually you don't get it to happen in the boardroom. So you need to have a kind of space where you can experiment. And the experimentation is usually done in laboratories for products. But where do you find the laboratory for organizational development? And we missed that. So we said, let's start a laboratory, an experimental place for organizational development. And of course, that was not only human capital of employees, it was also for customer relationships, and even politicians and the government became important because they are setting the context for the business. So therefore, the Future Center became a kind of prototyping space for moving into what we don't know about the future. So in a simple term, you can say a question, have you been in the future? Most people have not. So let's try to see how we can move into the future and then return to the present. And that is related to risk aptitude. Most people are afraid to move into the future. So therefore, they try to resist the future. But it's the same as the tide. It's coming whether you don't want it or not. So you have to prepare yourself for it. And that's why you need a space or a place to test it. And then we looked around the world to see where could we find some learnings on this. And we found some in actually Germany, together with people in Mercedes-Benz, who at that time had a future prototyping space in Berlin, and it I don't know if it's still there. We learned from Xerox Park in California. We learned from prototyping spaces in Japan. And we combined all that into Scandia Future Center.
And could one say that like a research and development department has a laboratory for doing research and doing product innovation? A future center is like a place for doing management innovation or organizational innovation?
Yes, it's a good summary with a little twist. Research is looking backwards, and the future center is looking forward. So therefore, it's for search.
Searching for the future, so to say.
Yes, for search of what you don't know that you don't know. And if you then combine it with what we said earlier, there are two dimensions in this with intellectual capital. One is to understand it. The other one is to do it. So a future center is not only to think about it, it's prototyping, where you can take risks and you can fail and you can also move forward.
And I read that the Scandia Future Center was established in 1996. And I think I saw three bullet points. It was a meeting place for future work. It was to build bridges between organizations, functions, and cultures. And it was to increase knowledge exchange. How was this done? How did this place look like? Was it a building? Was it several rooms? What kind of furniture were there? What kind of events were there? What kind of facilitation did you do?
Well, the most intriguing facilitation is to reduce the risk, to reduce the fear for the risk of moving into the future. So the core part of it is how do we reduce that kind of fear among people? And you do it by having a kind of welcoming design of the working space. So the starting point of it is actually that you get a smell, a nice smell, when you walk into it. If you have an ugly smell or a smell that gives you fear, then you don't walk into the future. The second part of it is to simplify the walk into the future by having nice music. So we had contextual music from the archipelago of Stockholm. That was also adding to it. And after perceiving the good smell of the context and the music of the context, you entered into the smell of freshly baked buns mm-hmm. from the kitchen. So it immediately helped you to navigate from the entrance to the kitchen. And it was based also on a very simple observation that the exchange of knowledge is more frequent and easier in a kitchen than in a boardroom. So we wanted to make the kitchen as a kind of a hotspot.
Like the place where people get their coffee or smoke the cigarette is a very good place for exchanging knowledge.
Yes. So why do we have boardrooms? What's the return on investment on that?
Never calculated it. Perhaps it would be a good idea to do so.
Exactly. And then you realize you can use the full amount or part of the amount and put it into the future center or similar construct. We experimented with so many dimensions and we saw how it simplified the interaction among knowledge workers or people to look into difficult questions. It was politicians as well as researchers as well. So we were living actually what is today called the pentahelix or triple helix in that space.
And then from this prototype of a future center that you did in Sweden, several other future centers emerged, I think mainly in the Netherlands, in Japan, in Germany perhaps as well. There was this booklet called Open Futures Operating System for Future Centers, I think in 2009. Like, what was the story behind this spreading? Where did people pick up that idea of future centers and what kind of future centers were built then?
It emerged as all knowledge sharing. You get to hear about this, and probably in the same way as we were searching for a laboratory to experiment with the organizational capital of our enterprise, other enterprises were seeing that they needed a similar one. So among others came a guy from the cabinet of Denmark, And he saw that, wow, we need that for application in Copenhagen in Denmark. So he went back and started a future center for three ministers. And the same happened with people coming from Holland, and the same happened from people coming from Germany, Norway, England. I even had visitors from MI5, and you know what they are doing. So they were really looking for hidden values and hidden assets, and they still do that. So and today there are around 50 future centers in Japan, and this is very interesting. So in Japan they are trying to combine these insights with the context of Asian thinking. So therefore they have a 50 center, future centers. Another part of this knowledge sharing that came about was that the future center it's not the label per se. You can call it Mind Lab, you can call it something else, but it is to have this space for prototyping. So that you could find it in Italy, you could find it in many countries, but not in US. And this is very interesting. Could it be that the management culture, according to American learnings, is too rigid to explore, while the Asians are picking up on it? And this is a very soft early observation, that the Asian capability to look into the new ways of organizing is spreading around. And you can see it in a very simple illustration. While GM were struggling and almost failed to the really bottom part of it, Toyota became the leading car producer in the world. So there is something in this observation to look into. But the future center can nowadays be called a wise place. And this is coming from Asia and Japan, and especially influenced by Professor Nonaka and his colleague Noboru Kono. Do we really find that the enterprise organization of today is wise, or do we need to renew the whole concept and continuously renew it to come closer to a wise place, both for the present generations of people as well as future generations of people?
You think of a kind of evolution of management from traditional management via intellectual capital management, knowledge management, towards wise management, like wise leaders in organizations?
Very good. Very well put. And this is what you start to see when you look at the roots for the fruits. The wisdom is in the roots, not in the fruits.
Yeah, I like this metaphor very much, the metaphor of the tree, because a lot of people think of caring for the fruits, like pulling the fruits to let them grow faster, but it's about nurturing the roots, which is much more important than that.
And think about the common financial phrase, picking the low-hanging fruits. So you need to cultivate the roots, and that is why culture becomes so important, which is, of course, a part of the future center mission. And what we also learned from this dimension was that high tech is scaring for most people. So the first iteration of our future center was full of such fancy gadgets. But we realized that it was better to have an old typewriter, an old desk, an old chair than a new one, because it created a kind of a harmony for the brain. And there you see the soft cultural dimensions of it, to reduce the fear to move forward. And this is based on another observation, that only 3% of a population, workforce or citizens, are prepared to move forward. 97% are stuck in the fear to various degrees.
I think there was this formulation by John Nesbitt, who created this idea of the megatrends. And I think one of his megatrends were high tech and high touch, like where it's necessary or good to use new technology. It's a good thing, but it's not the only thing. There should also be emotional parts, which he meant by high touch. So perhaps also an old library with old paper books would be a good idea to have at a future center. And the typewriter that you mentioned?
Yes, and the typewriter or the old technology also leads you to start to realize that you have this evolution and the tide, and one of the most interesting ones is related to the keyboard of your laptop. You have a certain standard on it if you look at it, and it's called QWERTY. And the standard of the QWERTY was born roughly 100 years ago. But we still have it. And why do we have QWERTY? Because it was the mechanical problem of the fingers in the typewriter, not to jam. And therefore they developed this standard of QWERTY to reduce the speed of typewriting. But today we don't have the fingers. So we could actually increase the speed of typing by changing the standard. But we don't. And it's the same with accounting.
Oh, it takes some time.
Yes, it takes some time.
Earlier this year, we are now in 2017, a new booklet was published on future centers. It's called Future Center 3.0. Subtitle is Creating Our Entangled Futures. The 3.0, I think, means that the Scandia Future Center was the version one of future centers. Then all these future centers that emerged from that after that in Europe, in Asia, and so on were version two. And you're now thinking or seeing the first emergence of a future center version three. Can it be seen like that, this idea of future center 3.0?
Exactly. Very well put.
And what are the characteristics? What are the ideas behind the 3.0? What happens at the moment in the future center discipline?
Living the message of continuous renewal. So if we don't renew a future center, we are stuck. And that's what you see, among others, in Denmark. Denmark started with the first generation future center called Mind Lab. And that was had three principles. Three ministers, and when they started to assess the value of their future center as a governmental approach for it, they realized that two things that is extremely interesting. One was that by having a future center and with all its benefits, they could increase the speed of new lawmaking. So the timeline for developing new laws could be reduced. And as we know today, it takes a very, very long time in most countries. The second dimension was to increase the intelligence in the lawmaking to a higher level of intelligence. So those two benefits led Denmark to start the second generation of a Mind Lab. And now they are starting their third generation. It's called Blocks.dk. So it's a combination of a Mind Lab, Future Center, and Design Center to look in and live the message of tomorrow for the future of Denmark.
Did I get that right, that Future Center can be part of an organization, like a company, or part of a government, or also being a place for civil society? Are these three types of future centers?
Most likely, and that's what we have been seeing around the world. In Norway, for example, it was started by a company called Norwegian Tipping, a gaming company working for the society benefits. There has also been prototyping on health futurizing centers to develop the new kind of health making, not hospitals. And taking that metaphor, you can realize that hospitals were once upon a time an innovation. And in Germany, it was called Krankenhauses. And those hospitals were actually there to isolate people who had some kind of diseases from the rest of society. Today, we don't need to do that. And we should probably not do it. We should offer them a totally different organizational approach through digital hospitals or digital Krankenhauses, which you can do, and you can even offer them treatment through the digitalized services. For example, you can, instead of taking a pill, you can have an electronic signal which you put into your ear that influences your amygdala, which influences your immune defense, do you then need to have a hospital for that?
Perhaps in some cases not.
Exactly. And this is one of the largest budget items in societies of today, the healthcare. So we need really to develop the organizational system for healthcare. And for that, we need future centers. And that will be a part of the Future Center 3.0 to look into it. And it might take us to the wise places. So we are starting to prototype that in collaboration with the Japanese experiences into Europe. And I invite the listeners of this to contact Simon or me to explore this, because our kids need it. Otherwise, we are going to drown in the budget deficits.
In, at least in the light of the demographic change that a lot of Western societies are in the middle of at the moment. If someone's interesting of the listeners to get some more information about future centers, there's the so-called Future Center Alliance, also with a website called futurecenteralliance.com, where you can find some examples, the Mind Lab you said, the Dialogues House, Japanese Future Centers, Telecom Italia, and so on. I think there's a map on the website as well. There's a short film, like 10 minutes, I think, where you get some impressions about future centers. Also the hints of when the Future Center Summit takes place. I think a conference on with all the practitioners and researchers in the field of future centers. Is this the place to go when one wants to keep up to date in terms of future centers?
Yes. And the next Future Center Summit is going to take place in May 5 or 6 next year in Denmark, in Copenhagen. And remember that the future center is actually an impossibility. The future can never be in center, but it can be focused as a center. It's a moving target.
So perhaps as a last question, in your brain, what's going on regarding the future? Like, what's the next thing? What's the next hot topic you think that will emerge in that field of intellectual capital and future centers?
I think there are at least four dimensions which might trigger the fifth. The first one is that we have a geopolitical shift from the Western world to Asia. And as I'm being also professor in Hong Kong Polytechnic University for almost 10 years, it gave me the opportunity to see what's going on there. And there are so many things that we totally miss out on. And that's why the geopolitical observation is extremely important. It creates the context for our futurizing. It might be learning from places like Shenzhen. And Shenzhen was, as some of you might know, the first prototyping new capitalistic city in China. Out of that can grow a number of transformations like Shanghai and Tianjin and others. So be aware of the geopolitical development in Asia. The second one is the shift of products to ideas, concepts, or softnomics. The Asian word for this, coined many years ago, is softnomics, the soft economics. And today we have also the circular economy, we have the intangible economy, the knowledge economy. But it's a tremendous shift in value creation, and the value galaxy might be in how you combine these ideas and soft dimensions. And it might be called trade in ideas. Trade in ideas. And one simple illustration of that is, of course, Spotify. It's going from the old traditional music orchestra into digital distribution and consumption of entertainment. The third dimension is probably the consequences of that, and it might be the development of blockchain and Bitcoin and digitalized packages, either of people or ideas, new currencies that are emerging based on the other two that I just mentioned earlier. And the fourth one is that when you go from the geopolitical perspective through the digital filter, you realize that the most intriguing part is probably your brain. And that is called neuroscience. So instead of having a kind of financial controller on board of a company, you need to have a chief neuroscientist. And this was tested, actually. So I was sitting on the advisory board of Future Center Lef in Holland. And there we had, one of the colleagues was neuroscientist, to insert some of those learnings into the futurizing of the Rijkswaterstaat in Holland.
Do you see this as a trend, that companies are like recruiting neuroscientists to enhance their management practices?
Some of them are clever enough to do that, but it's still blocked by fear. Because if you take a traditional legal advisor or financial controller, etc., they don't know even how to speak with a neuroscientist. And the same goes for the neuroscientists. They ask themselves, why should I speak to this financial controller or stock market guy when they have so much to pick up on? For example, if you look into a traditional office of today, the light in the office could be changed through the LED technology and the software which you can add to it from a company called BrainLit in Lund. And then you can actually direct and program the light in the office, so you reduce the sleeping problems of the staff.
With all these smart lights that are available nowadays, it's an easy thing to do.
Yes, it is. But to understand that if you do that, you're impacting the quality of life of your staff or your citizens, or that you expose them to the blue light for a frequency of a day. And that push back the melatonin, etc. So you get a more healthy sleeping and get to the REM sleep. And that will improve your performance next day.
So what we do with the plants and the grocery nowadays, we should do to people in the future as well.
Yes.
Perhaps one last thought on my famous citation from your 1997 paper. You have one sentence there saying, most of this is common sense, but the challenge is to turn it into common practice. When we look back the last decades, we had this idea of a director of intellectual capital. We had the idea of chief knowledge officers, of chief learning officers, and so on. But the adoption rate in practice, I think, or I see at the moment, is not very high. So for all the practitioners out there, what do you think would be important steps in the future to get more people to practice?
It is related to this fear. So the common sense is actually to get a lot of blockage away. And when you talk about the time delay of diffusion of an idea, it takes a long time to get things going from early observations to common practice. This navigation of Central European time, CET, it took roughly 140 years for the politicians to agree upon Greenwich, 140 years. And then before that, it took almost 200 years to agree upon the discovery of the tide and the impact of the navigation. So more than 300 years to get to what we think is common sense, that we have different times because of the rotation of the Earth. But it's based on the way you think. If you realize that the Earth is rotating around us, we are sitting on a rotating space in our universe, we realize, why should we block it into that? It's called firmamente in Italian. The theory of the firm is to put it into a package. And we have, instead of seeing what I think in German, you call it Gesellschaft or Gemeinschaft. It's so much smarter because it helps the brain to realize that we are living in a galaxy of value units. We are living with a body with a number of cells that is renewing. And we should apply that into the galaxy of value cells. then we will create the wealth of tomorrow, which we can measure in the national IC maps, because that is to the benefit of next generations, our kids.
If I get it right, you say that it takes a lot of time until the thinking changes direction, and we have just to be patient and keep on going and learning.
Persistency is very, very important.
So thank you very much that you took yourself the time for this podcast. And I close with the traditional saying of you as well, happy future, Leif.
May I add one little note, as you are very well aware of the meaning of the word Zukunft, the future. And Zukunft stands for zu kennen, to knowledge. And that's where the future is.
So we will start searching and creating it right now. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.